This is Cameron Hicks. And you're listening to the Debbie Scott Radio Network, broadcasting live around the world on Spreaker.com. Tune in and rip the knob off. Wait, maybe they're listening on a laptop. Tune in and rip the mouse out. Wait, maybe they have a tablet. What can you rip off a tablet? You know what? Whatever your generation, tune in to Debbie Scott Radio Network and tear something off. On Spreaker.com.
Mr. Bojangles by Sammy Davis Jr., and I want to clear up my mess up. So sorry, Sandy. Sandy is Jimmy Clanton's executive associate and best friend, not his wife. So I'm so sorry, Sandy. Oh, I'm so sorry, sweetheart. I want to welcome in Scott, Al Scott, into the chat room. I almost called him Scott Al. Oh, my goodness. Welcome to the chat room, Al. Thank you for coming in. Okay, so this is special edition featuring the living the legend, Mr. Jimmy Clanton, right here on the Debbie Scott Radio Network. I am Debbie Scott. We are streaming live around the world, and so I have Jimmy on the line with me. And Jimmy, you want to say hi to everybody?
Well, it's a privilege. I enjoy talking with people like yourself and contacting with fans that would be familiar with me and my era of music from the 50s and 60s. And so, really, it's a pleasure to be with you all.
Oh, thank you so much. So, can we just start at your humble beginnings? I know Judy. She was the first to contact you, and she told me some things. And I said, we're gonna find out a whole bunch about him when he gets on the air with me. So you're the host with the most tonight. You got the mic. Go ahead, sweetie.
Well, I grew up. I was born down in the Bayou country of Louisiana. I was born in Golden Meadow, Louisiana. My mother was the full-blooded Cajun woman, and boy, I tell you, they were as dark as the darkest Latinos you ever saw, and they had thick hair, and that's why at this time, almost 80 years of age, if you ask any of the guys in my era who has the best head of hair, they'll tell you Jimmy Clanton. And I got it. Oh yeah, and I got that head of hair from my Cajun mother. I moved to Birmingham, Alabama shortly after my dad got a job, and then by the time I was about, I guess, five or maybe six, my dad was transferred, and we transferred to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and that's actually where I grew up. And from an early age, for whatever reason, I really wanted to learn to play guitar, because I would go to my grandmother's house in Alabama, and you were forced to go to their Fire and Brimstone Baptist Church, or else you were going to hell the next morning. And so I went to that church, and we would sing from the hymn book, and they played music around there. Somebody had a guitar, showed it to me. I just plunked away at it, and it clicked. I said, you know what? I'd like to learn to play this. So I went back home to Baton Rouge, and I cut grass. I mowed grass and saved up $12, and my dad took me to a pawn shop, and I bought a $12 pawn shop guitar. Now, the thing is, I was left-handed.
Yeah.
They didn't have any left-handed guitars. So I said, well, I'm going to have to buy a right-handed guitar and just teach myself to play right-handed guitar, even though I'm left-handed. So that's what I did. And so eventually, by this time I was at junior high school, and a couple of us guys got together, and we played music together, and I would listen to the radio, and not realizing it, but I truly just had such a gift for guitar playing, because I learned leaps and bounds. I made up my own system of following songs. You hum it, I could play it. And so by the time I was 17, I was in another little high school band there, and just playing guitar. And that's all I wanted to do, was play guitar. And one day, out of the clear blue, we were at rehearsal, and I overheard in this band I was playing with, this is out of context, but the band leader said, well, I have to pay Charlie, I have to pay him $5 a night more because he sings. And I went, oh. And I just, that grabbed me. I didn't do anything with it, but it just grabbed me.
Right.
And I knew I could sing hymns because I would do that from the Baptist hymn book. So by the time I just barely turned, I was still 17, I guess. I was out of high school at 17. And somebody had told this band leader, who was a couple of years older than me, he had a group that he played all the Louisiana nightclubs, because in my state, you could go into a place that served alcohol at 18.
Yeah.
And somebody told him about me. And so he came and he heard me play, and he came up to me and he said, look, he said, I'm going to go from a little slow jazz type music. I want to go into this, into the swamp pop, the rock and roll rhythm and blues sound. And he said, I really need a guitar player. And he said, you come with me. And he said, I've got the outlets. I've got the clubs. I've got the engagements. And you'll enjoy playing and you'll make money at it. So to make a long story short there, I began playing with him. And I guess after about the second month we played together, I went over to him. I said, Dick, I said, you know, you're doing all the singing. So you're doing like almost 4 hours when we do these engagements. And man, you're going to lose your voice, you know. And I said, now, I wouldn't mind doing a couple of songs here and there. I said, oh, by the way, I said, the other band I was in, the guy that sang, they gave him $5 extra. So he and him hauled around, and he said, well, we'll see. Now, you got to remember something. $5 in 1957, do you have any idea?
It's like $1,000 now. Yes, I do.
You've got it right. And so he said, well, let's just check it out. So I'll never forget. I went and learned. I'm going to take a sip of water here, okay?
Go ahead, honey. It's all good. Go ahead.
So he said, well, we'll see how that works. So I had heard this song. It was the typical Louisiana swamp pop sound, because the people that I grew up with musically, that I was influenced by, were the early days recordings of Ray Charles and the one and only Fats Domino.
Oh, there you go. You're answering the question that Judy wanted me to ask you. Who was your influences? There you go, Judy.
They're the ones. And I was so influenced by that sound. And so I wanted to play guitar that way. And so when he said, we'll give you a try, the first song I thought of was on a specialty label by a fellow named Aaron Neville. I'll never forget it as long as I live.
I love him.
It was called Ooh Wee Baby. Ooh Wee Baby, I love you so. Mm-hmm. Ooh Wee Baby, don't ever let me go. Fool that I am to think you could love me too. And we had a tenor sax and a lead trumpet, so we had that swamp pop sound. Ooh, baby, don't want no one but you. So I learned that song. Now you got to remember, there were no cassette recorders, there were no recording devices invented, so you had to listen to it over and over to memorize all these songs.
Right.
So
right.
I went to him this one again, and I said, okay, I'm ready, I got this song. And unbeknownst to me, okay, I'm going to be very, very humble about what I'm going to say.
Okay.
I'm being very honest, but I'm being humble. Okay? So I get up there to the front. Dick said, all right, do your song. So there I am with that curly Q hairdo that I specialized in. Waterfall, curly Q, whatever you want to call it. And I got up there with a guitar, and I started singing that song. And, oh, my God, every girl in the place just flooded down to the front.
Whoa.
And they were, the way they were looking at me, I thought I was getting ready to get inhaled and queued up and eaten up. You know, and I'm going, whoa, what's going on here? I had no idea, to be quite honest with you, that I was told, I was good looking kid. And I didn't know it. I swear I didn't.
Well, you are, you were, and you know what? I looked through your pictures and I was like, you know, you still look like Jimmy. You still look like yourself.
I've kind of aged. I've aged pretty well.
Yeah, you
so
did.
I did that song, and the next thing you know, when everybody wanted me to sing constantly, so I became the main singer. So one day, because he was a few years older than me, he was dating a girl, and she came over to him, and she said, "Dick," she said, "now I'm in Baton Rouge, which is 90 miles from New Orleans, and she said, Dick, you know, there's somebody else I admit of, and they said there's a recording studio in New Orleans, and for $25, you can rent out an hour of recording time. Why don't you and the guys go down there and just hear what you sound like?" And by this time, we were really the number one white rhythm and blues swamp pop band in all of my area.
Uh-huh.
There was nobody else. We were the ones. So we go down there, and I was crazy about my first love, and she and I were arguing all the time. And I ended up, out of the clear blue, writing a song. I can't believe I wrote a song. And so we're in that recording studio, but I forgot, I didn't think about recording. Dick was going to do all the singing. So we record these original songs he had written. And the next thing you know, he said, "Okay, I'm finished." And the recording engineer said, "Hey," he says, "you got 6 more minutes. You got anything else? Because you paid for 6 more minutes." And Dick said, "No, man, I don't have anything." And he looked over at me. He said, "Jimmy, you got anything?" I said, "Well, I got this little song called I Trusted You." And I couldn't believe it, but I had memorized the song out of the clear blue. So we put that down on tape. And so we go back to Baton Rouge. And about 5 or 6 days later, I get this phone call. And this guy says, "Jimmy," he said, "my name is Johnny Vincent from Jackson, Mississippi." And he said, "I own a record company called Ace Records." Well, I knew Ace Records because there was a big hit on Ace Records by Huey Smith and the Clowns called "Boogie Woogie, Rockin' Pneumonia and the Boogie Woogie Flu." Johnny Rivers covered it, but Huey Smith had the original hit on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew their label, and I'm thinking, what's he calling me about? And the bottom line is, he talked to me for about 5 minutes, invited me to come to New Orleans. I went to New Orleans, talked with him. He asked me to sign a contract just for me, but I could continue with the Rockets. We put out this record, I Trusted You, for about, I guess, 3 months. We got airplay, and we got a lot of gigs from it. So then he calls me. I'm getting ready to bring this to a head here. I don't want to talk up all night on this. And so he calls me back, and he says to me, he said, "Look, it's time to do some more recording. Have you written anything else?" I'm going, "What?" You know, that was just an accident, that one song, for heaven's sake.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, I better start writing. And do you know, it is unbelievable, but I guess I ended up finding out I had a gift for writing songs as well as being a guitar player. But being a guitar player turned out to be the blessing, because I was such an expert at the guitar, I could write these incredible melodies because I knew all of the chord changes for these songs. And so the next thing you know, he said, "Get ready." I go there, and I go into the studio, and I said, "Okay, I got this song." And I started just playing it, and I'll never forget, it blew me away. The saxophone player looked over at me, and he said, "Jimmy, that is a hit." And it was a song called "Just a Dream."
Nice.
So we recorded it, and about 3 weeks later, Johnny Vincent called me again, and he said, "Get a bag packed. I'm going to put you on a plane. You're going to Philadelphia. There's a brand new show called American Bandstand, and I've already booked you. You're going to be able to perform this song on that show." Oh. Now, I never had an airplane before. To me, Philadelphia was like going to the moon or going to Mars, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I just knew about those big cities out there, but nothing like that. And so, sure enough, I go to Philadelphia. I listen on this thing again. When I come on, nobody see me. All the girls just flock down. And the next thing you know, I'm going, "Man, well, what is going on here?" Johnny Vincent sold over 100,000 copies of Just a Dream the day after I was on American Bandstand.
Oh, my goodness. I got goosebumps.
And you probably have that song available to play.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. You ready for a song break?
This is the song that started it all for Jimmy Clanton. Wow.
Oh, just a dream, Jimmy Clanton. Woo! Okay, you got me a swooning now, too, okay, just like everybody in the chat room.
thank you, Debbie. I understand from my executive associate, and sometimes they say that's better than a wife.
Yeah.
My executive associate, Sandy Weeks, is telling me there's several fans.
Yes, you have, you have Audrey.
Audrey, okay, yeah.
And you have Mary Teresa.
Oh, my gosh, yeah, Mary Teresa from San Antonio, right.
And you have, let me jump in the chat room. I can tell you everybody's in there. Doc Holliday's in there. Linda Grisso.
Oh, hey, Linda. Yeah.
And
I know Lori Bird is there.
And Lori Bird's there. And you see, I'm going through the chat room. The chat's going a little bit fast for me right now.
That's okay. That's
so,
okay.
Yeah, you got some fans in there right now.
Yeah, and Lori. She came to my last show. She drove down from Michigan. And Linda Grisso, she came all the way from Oklahoma City to California to see me at a show. And then she came all the way down to Baton Rouge to see my last one-man show. I tell you, I've got some fans. They blow me away how they come from so many long-distance places.
Well, Doc Holliday said you still got some pipes on you.
Well, thank you. After I did Just a Dream, that record took off unbelievably so worldwide, and I began touring all over America. The bus tours, I mean, literally every state in the union. I went to Australia. We were there for a long, big tour. Down in the Philippines, I was in Jamaica. And to show you how things recently are, now, here I was between 19, 20 years of age. Now, I will be... this is true. I will be 80 years old this next September. Wow. And 2 years ago, out of the clear blue, I got a call, and I ended up doing a series of one-man concerts in Bangkok, Thailand. I thought, you know, after this many years that my music is that well known, and it's just been incredible to start a career from one song like that. And so after I did a series of songs, one day this one writer, Doc Thomas and his cohort Morty Schumann, they wrote a lot of big hits. They wrote Save the Last Dance for Me, for the Drifters. They wrote This Magic Moment. They wrote several things. They wrote Hushabye. They wrote things for Elvis. And he kept bugging me about listening to one of his songs. Well, he had a repertoire, you know. So he gives me this song, and I'm going to let you play in just a minute. So I go to the studio with it, and I thought, okay, this is kind of up-tempo, and it's got the horns. That's like the Jimmy Clanton sound, and actually it reached the top 10 in the charts faster and higher than anything that I ever recorded. And so I get in, and I record it. And as I'm walking out, now you got to listen to this, folks. I'm walking out, and the backup singers walk over to me with a strange look on their face. And they said, Jimmy, are you sure that you never recorded this as Go Bobby Go? Because I would swear we did this same song, and it was a Go Bobby Go. And I said, honey, I'm Jimmy. Why would I do a song Go Bobby Go? So I dropped it. So I do this song. Recorded called Go Jimmy Go. It becomes a big, big hit for me nationwide. So I'm doing this big show and I'm backstage and who walks over to me but my friend, Bobby Rydell. And he looks up at me because he's I'm taller than he is. Well, he knows he's shorter than I am, sure. Yeah. And so is, well, anyway. So he looks up at me and he says, you son of a gun, you stole my song. I said, what the heck are you talking about? He said, I recorded Go Bobby Go. And he said, you went there and Go Jimmy Go. And I said, well, why didn't you put it out? He said, well, the company decided to go elsewhere. And I said, well, Well, you go, because it's a big hit for me, baby, so bye-bye-bye. So you can go ahead and play this song that Bobby Rydell decided not to put out. Jimmy Clanton did, and it became a huge hit for me called Go, Jimmy, Go.
Go, Jimmy, go. Jimmy Clanton, the living legend, on the line with us tonight, and he has shared his most intimate and wonderful stories. So, Jimmy, you're the host with the most. You have the mic. Go ahead, darling.
Well, thank you. During those days of touring, of course, I finally got to meet, and I was really so happy about this because the artists, like myself, that were in the 50s, we had a fellowship and a camaraderie with each other that did not come about from the 60s, and there's a lot of reasons for that. And so mostly in the 50s, I did shows with the incredible talented people like the Original Platters and that incredible voice of Tony Williams, the lead singer, Clyde McFadder, you know. Does she love me with all her heart? Should I worry when we're apart? It's a lover's question I'd like to know. People like Clyde McFadder. I'm talking about talent that was just mind-boggling. And so that ended up bringing me into the presence, because of my songs and my hits, to Mr. Alan Freed, who was indeed the epitome of the rock and roll DJ. What he started doing in Cleveland, Ohio, he started playing the records of these artists, but he was the first one then. He hired those artists to come to the town and do concerts so people could come hear the artist live. And so when that became so successful, New York saw what he was doing. They hired him, he came to New York, and he started doing the same thing. And so I got a call from my agency, and for whatever reason, Alan Freed just took to me. And I truly became his favorite single white young artist, to the point where he would have me on every show he had. He would fly me in ahead of time just so I could hang out with him on his radio show, me and Jackie Wilson. And so I did so many shows with Alan, and he and I were really, really close. And one day, backstage, without any fanfare, he walked over to me and he said, I'm getting ready to go to Hollywood to film my final, as far as he says, really, it's going to be my iconic rock and roll movie. And he told me a little about the storyline. He said it's going to be the story of a guy named Johnny Melody. And he told me about it, and he looked over and he said, I would like for you to play Johnny Melody in my movie. So I...
Can I just say one thing real quick? Every name, just about every name that you've mentioned, I have them in the playlist tonight.
All right. Yeah, you're doing your homework, Debbie.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So we go to Hollywood, and I filmed this movie called Go Johnny Go, because it was based on Johnny Melody, the lead. And so that movie opened up so many more doors for me, because I was this teen idol. I don't know where I got that title, but somebody... One of them did, Alan Freed or Dick Clark, I'm not sure. So I was a teen idol. And so I played the lead in Johnny Melody and Go Johnny Go. And that movie was all over. It's played on the Turner Classic many, many times over the years. And so everything is going great. And the next thing you know, though, I'm in the Army. But just before I go to the Army, I had recorded a recording session. When I come out of the Army, I call Johnny Vincent, and I said to him, I'm hoping I've still got some fans. On the other hand, what do we have in the can? What did I record that we could bring out with right away? So as I make some appearances, I'll have something that the fans can relate to. And he said, Jimmy, he said, man, he said, we only got one song. And he said, it was a throwaway song. It wasn't even going to be the big one of the session. I said, I don't care. I don't care. We got to put out something. Well, I am so glad that the song you're getting ready to play, Debbie, turned out to be the quickest top 10 hit of my entire career. This song just absolutely took over the nation so quickly, and there's a big argument now as to what is the signature song for Jimmy Clanton. Is it Just a Dream, or is it the one you're going to play called Venus in Blue Jeans?
We'll be right back, folks. Venus in Blue Jeans, Jimmy Clanton. Okay, Doc Holliday at wants to know, Jim, do you remember the show at the Steel Pier in Atlantic City when they had to move us from the end of the pier to the front part because, oh, everybody's starting to type. Hold on, I got to jump in the chat room. Okay, he says the front part because they was afraid the pier would collapse. From the size of the crowd, I was the guitar player for Jerry Lee Lewis. You were on that show. They put me, Jerry, and Joey D in a limo on the side of the pier and drove us to the front, and that the pier was moving under the limo, and Jerry wanted to wait and see the diving horse. The pier was collapsing, and Jerry wanted to see a horse dive. Do you remember that?
I vaguely remember something about that. Yeah, that was probably the craziest thing that's happened in my career.
Well, that was from Doc Holliday that he wanted to know if you remember that. All right, you're the host with the most. You got the mic.
I had mentioned when I first came on about some of the poignant stories and things that have come back to me verbally from people. You know, here I am never, ever watching TV, never, ever listening to the radio about any programs about if you're listening and you've got some talent and you want to be somebody in music. That never, ever entered my mind. I was going to go to LSU and I was going to get a degree in geology. And I was going to study rocks to bring out oil. And then on the weekends, I would play music and live happily ever after.
Right.
I had no idea of a career. That never, ever, ever entered my mind. Everything happened just accidentally, if there is such a thing. We won't go into that. But I wrote Just a Dream in 20 minutes.
It was divine intervention.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. You said it. One of the things that happened, I was in Philadelphia. I finished a show, and it was kind of dark in the back there where we go to our vehicles. And this guy starts walking toward me. It's kind of something like out of a dark movie. Very well built, one of those Fu Manchu mustache things. And we looked over, had steel eyes, and he just kept walking to me, and he put his hand out. And so I kind of put my hand out, wondering what's, and I took his hand, and all he said was, "I've been looking for you and waiting for you." And I'm thinking, oh my God, you know, did I mess with his girlfriend or did
something? You know? He was just going to ask you that.
I thought I was getting ready to get killed, you know?
Right.
And here's the story. I'll probably choke up again. Here's the story that man told me. You can't make this stuff up, folks. He looked at me, and he's got a steel grip. He's got my hand. And he says, "I have been waiting to finally get to you to tell you thank you." He said, "Jimmy," he said, "I was in Vietnam, and I was captured."
Oh.
And he said, "I was tortured every day." He said, "I will not describe to you the things that they did to me." He said, "But I will tell you this much." He said, "After a period of time, when I woke up," he said, "I knew they were coming for me, and it was going to be another," as he called them, "session." And he said, "I knew that I was not going to make it through another session if something didn't come to me, or if something did." And he said, "They came to me, and as they were taking me to that chamber," he said, "all of a sudden, Jimmy," now this guy is staring holes through me, and he's got my hand in a steel grip. He said, "all of a sudden, Jimmy, when they getting ready to do these things to me," he said, "all of a sudden," he said, "I just came up and out of myself," and he said, "I saw kind of like a vision. He said, I saw you singing Just a Dream on stage. Mm. And I kind of like singing along with you. And he said, the next thing I know, he said, that this time had passed, and they said to me, go back to your cell. And he said, they were through with me. He said, well, the thing is, the next morning they came again. And he said, I knew that I had to come up with something again to get through that. And he said, lo and behold, I look up, and he said, I'm just up and out of myself, but this time you're on stage. You're singing Just a Dream. But I'm on stage and with you, and I'm singing Just a Dream as well. And he said, I got through that session. He said, they took me back, and they said, we threw with you because you're crazy. You sing while we torture.
Oh, me. Oof.
And, yeah. He said, eventually, I got away. And he said, I always knew that once I got back to the States, he said, I would have to find Jimmy Clanton to tell him, thank you. You saved my life. He turned around and walked away.
Oh, God. I have goosebumps everywhere.
So, things like that from a song that I sung, that I sang, you know, it's kind of mind-boggling. And then the other side is kind of cute. I did a show a couple of years ago, and I'm out in the corridor signing autographs, and a sweet little old lady, she looked like she probably was a little older than me, with a guy, she smiled at me, and I'm just talking. I said, I'm glad you're here and so forth. And I said, have you ever seen me live? No, Jimmy, this is my first time. I said, what? She said, yeah, after all these years. And she said, this is my boyfriend that I started going with after I realized that I would never get you. So I got... I get that sometimes. and so she said, I'm so glad to be here. So I couldn't believe it. And she looked at it, and then she had this little grin, and she said, by the way, she said, Just a Dream is my favorite song of all time, and I've always loved you in that song, and I finally get to see you sing it. And by the way, Jimmy, she said, our tombstone says, Just a Dream. Do you know her daughter sent me a picture? It must be a $10,000 tombstone in granite. And sure enough, it says, Just a Dream. So I got on stage that night, and she was out there. And as I was getting ready to sing it, I said, now, don't put that tombstone to use for sure, not while I'm singing.
Right.
So, so there are so many things like that, you know.
Right.
I went through an era... As the years passed, I did a few shows here and there. And, of course, so much had taken over. You know, the English invasion had taken over, and you had the Vietnam protest bands, and you had, and then it went, and then that went right into the heavy metal sound. And there was a period for a good many years there where my era and my love song, because I'm a love song singer, I'm a love song writer. And so through those years, I just, pretty much just kind of went underground. I did some shows here and there. And then, lo and behold, I get a call from a casino in New Orleans, and somebody from that casino said, can you find Jimmy Clanton? Because he's like a hometown boy, and he was so well-known here, and the fans from his era. Well, they found me, and there's a band down there that played with me. And so I did some shows down there, my era, my music. And one day I had written a song, and I'm going to let you play it as the very last one when we go off tonight. And all of a sudden, I wrote this song because I thought, if I'm getting ready to do my last show, where would I want it to be? And I thought, no question about it, I'd like it, my one-man show, to be in Louisiana. So I wrote this song, and I happened to play it that night at that casino. There wasn't a dry eye in the place. And the next day, people were calling the promoter. We want a copy of that Louisiana song that Jimmy did. We got to have that song. And so the tenor sax player said, you know what? You should go to Pershing Wells' studio in Houma He's got a studio. He calls it Sacolet Productions. Sacolet is a Louisiana term for crappie fish. I know what they are. Sacolet. And so I thought, oh, you know, I'm not ready to go back and all that. Well, make a long story short, I came from another casino and I stopped in, and he just kind of hit me as being, you know what? He might get back up what he says. I said, you know what? I've got a song. I'll give you one shot with this one song. So it's a long story. I did that song. He produced it. And the next thing you know, he sent me a dub copy of it. And I wept like a baby. I could not believe what this guy did with this song. Because of that, I started writing again. And I decided I want to write the whole 360 degrees. I want to write a bubblegum song, a gospel song, a top 40 song, a blues song, and I want to write a smooth jazz love song. And then I want to do Love in Louisiana. And so this girl, Terry McPhail Chisson, she sang with Pershing with some recordings, and so she sang with me, and she did backup with me, and so I put together a whole album of all songs that I wrote that totally does that spectrum. Also, a country, easy, soft, easy sound country called Don't Let Me Go, and so you're going to play some cuts from that, okay?
Okay.
Just because Jimmy Clanton, I feel, has tried to grow musically, especially with my songwriting. And I believe I accomplished that. I'm happy with it. So the next thing you're going to play is the very first cut from that, and it's called Everybody Needs Love. Hope y'all enjoy.
Nope.
Oh, such a crooner, such a great voice. Oh, Everybody Needs Love by the living legend, Jimmy Clanton, right here on the Debbie Scott Radio Network. You're the host with the most, Jimmy. You got the mic, honey.
As I spent time over a period of time there recording, the next thing you know is that it looks like I'm going to do an album, because I ended up doing 10 brand new songs, although I reproduced Just a Dream. And I would like to say that all my music is available on my store and my website, jimmyclanton.com. Carolyn Otworth is a million-dollar web designer, and she did a website for me that is just as good as anything anybody has out there. And all my music, everything is available. Pictures, everything, stories about Jimmy Clanton at jimmyclanton.com. But like this producer said, we were talking about this one guy, I won't say who he was, had a great natural voice. He said, but Jimmy, he said, the thing when you hear him, you know what you notice? I said, well, he said, that boy ain't never been hurt.
Huh.
And When he said that, it went through me like a laser, because I realized that most of the songs I wrote and I was singing, I had been through a lot of hurt, and you just can't hide it, you know, when you're writing songs. But then you try to write songs to where the love affair goes perfectly well. Well, anyway, here's a song you're going to play, and Terry McPhail Chisson, I fell in love with this girl's voice, and I even called her. I said, I have never written a song for a duet. Would you like to do it with me? She said, absolutely. So I wrote this song. It's I called it kind of an easy country song, and it is the favorite of a lot of my fans, and it's from that CD, Everybody Needs Love. It's called Don't Let Me Go, and you're going to play it now, Bobby. Wow.
Oh, Don't Let Me Go, Jimmy Clanton. Oh, living legend on the line with me. So you are the host with the most. You got the mic. Go ahead, sweetheart.
Well, through this particular time, I got this black cat named Decker, and our other cat is named Black. So we got Black and Decker.
I didn't know you was gonna say that.
Decker, I walked by the sofa to get a thing of water, he slashes that because he thinks I'm going to leave. I'm not leaving, okay? Through this time, I think also fans always ask me about, you know, who did you know? And I do have an incredible story about Elvis Presley.
Okay.
I was in Memphis back in 59, and we were doing a big concert there. And out of the blue, I asked some guys, I said, is Elvis in town by any chance? And somebody said, you know, he actually is. I said, is there any chance just to meet him? Not thinking there'd ever be. And do you know, make a long story short, some phone calls were made, and lo and behold, not only was he home, but we got word, he said, come on over. So after the show, several of us were in the car, and we drive up to the pearly gates of heaven. That's what it looked like, you can imagine. You know, these big gates there, and there's a guard there, and he checks our name and so forth. He opens up the door, the big gate. So we go in, and there's something about remembering certain things people tell you that you never forget. And so I was the first one out of the car, and I walked right on up the steps, and I knocked on the door at Graceland. And the door opens, it's 1959, and the door opens, and there's Elvis. And he's got this yachting captain's hat on, and I'm just standing there, you know, my jaw dropped open. And I'm looking at it, and I can't believe to this day I remember what he said, because it was so out of the norm. He looked down at me, and he said, well, hi, Jimmy. He said, if I knew you were coming, I would have had Just a Dream on the record player.
Oh, my goodness.
Are you kidding me? And he was the nicest guy. So he gives us a tour of his house, and we go out to the back, and I said something about his cars. So it's about 11 o'clock at night, and, you know, because our show is over. And we walk out, and he's got some dim lights lighting up out there. And to the left was a 56 Cadillac Fleetwood, blue on the bottom, pink on the top. Yeah, seriously.
Yeah.
Okay. And he said, that's the first car I bought after I, you know, got my first royalties. And right in the middle was a baby blue Rolls Royce Silver Cloud. Mm. Silver Cloud Rolls Royce. At that time, I'm going, my God, that's probably a $50,000 car. And over to the right was the first Lincoln Continental Mark I.
Whoa.
And so we're talking for a little while, and all of a sudden, out of the corner of my eye, I see this giant bird jump up on a silver cloud Rolls Royce. And I see he's sitting there, and he's looking around, and then all of a sudden I see him look down, like between his legs, and all of a sudden he goes, bim, 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 and he starts pecking away, and the paint from the Silver Cloud Rolls Royce is flying everywhere.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I'm going, I do not believe what I just saw. And so I didn't say anything for a moment. We're talking with the others. And I look over. Sure enough, this big bird does the same thing again, paint flying everywhere. Come to find out it was a giant peacock, one of his pets. And so I couldn't stand it. And I grabbed Elvis's sleeve. I said, Elvis, I said, look, man. I said, are you aware? I said that you have this big pet bird. And Elvis, I just saw him fly up on your Rolls Royce, and I saw him pecking away at the paint.
Uh-huh.
And he just absolutely just exploded in laughter. He said, I know it, Jimmy. Is that not the biggest kick you ever saw? He says he sees himself a reflection, and he thinks it's another peacock, so it's competition, so he's trying to peck him and get him away. Isn't that the funniest
thing? Oh, God.
That's hilarious. That is hilarious. So, anyway.
He probably has to get his car repainted constantly, right?
Probably so. I saw him again a year later. I was out in Hollywood getting ready to film another rock and roll movie called Teenage Millionaire. And come to find out, he had a day off, and so a buddy of mine, and so we drove across town. He was filming Blue Hawaii, and so we got to be with him over there. I've got a picture with him on the stage, or the sound stage, as they call them, when he was on Blue Hawaii. If you'd like that, let Sandy know, and we'll autograph and send it to you.
Yes, I would.
Okay. Well, we're coming to a close here, okay? We've got two more songs because they reflect so much, okay? So here's that next song with Terry and myself. I wrote this, the first and only easy, soft jazz love song. And when it comes to songwriting, I don't think I've ever done any better. And I'm so pleased with this. And it's called Extraordinary Love. And it's from Everybody Needs Love CD.
Extraordinary Love, Jimmy Clanton. All right, you're the host with the most. You got the mic.
Many of the artists in the 60s never had the pleasure of knowing, much less doing shows with, the iconic rock and roll DJ of all time, Alan Freed.
Mm-hmm.
And Alan never, ever asked me for one penny under the table of payola. He never asked my record company. We never had to pay him $1 for any plays that he played on his radio station show. And he kind of got the shaft, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of payola back in those days.
You know what? While you're talking about that, you know, I heard about that, and unfortunately, I'm not one of those stations. I don't do that. I've never done it, and I never will. But there are a lot of stations that are doing that, and they're calling it song submission fees, or they're calling it, will you become a sponsor? I don't think any artist should be a sponsor of any station.
Well, that's what was happening back there in the late 50s.
Yeah.
But the iconic story of that was a surprise. One night, he called me late, and he said, "Meet me downstairs." He said, "I've got a surprise for you." So it was about 10 o'clock at night. So I come downstairs from the hotel, and we catch a cab. Now I'm going to show you the era that I was doing music in. We got in the cab, and when the cab hit, ow, Decker, well, he just scratched me.
He's saying you're talking too much.
when the cabbie was getting ready to pull out, he clicked on the whatever you call the thing to start, and it started at 25 cents. We actually gave the cabbie a 10 cent tip in 1958. Swear to God, the truth.
Wow. Oh, yeah, that's the mile meter.
Yep. So we go for a little while, and we get out, and we start walking up these stairs, and I asked him, I said, well, I said to Alan, I said, what is this place? He said, well, Jimmy, he said, this is an iconic nightclub in New York, and he said, it's called the Copacabana.
Oh, nice.
I said, oh, okay, that's cool. And so we walk up and we go in, and it's closed. They'd already done the last show. We're standing at a bar, nobody around. And so I'm looking at Alan. I'm going, yeah, it's a pretty place. And as I'm looking at Alan, he said to me, he said, Jimmy, you mentioned to me about an artist, a famous artist, that you've never met. He said, well, this particular artist you named is a friend of mine. And I just thought, seeing as he's in town, I'd introduce you. He said, so Jimmy, turn around. I turned around. Now, I'm 5'11 and a half. And I look up, and this guy takes my hand. He had the biggest hands I ever saw in my life. He's smiling down at me. He said, well, Jimmy, it's a pleasure to meet you. Nat King Cole.
Nice.
I went, oh, my living gosh. Do you know I was in such a, I didn't get his autograph, but that was the kind of guy Alan Freed was.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I tell you what, Debbie, I'm about run out of quick stories here, but I have a classic that happened on the set of Go Johnny Go, the movie I made. When I was out in Hollywood, we were going through preliminaries, and they were putting up the set, And there's one thing, one big set. It shows a street in New York, supposed to be in New York, and you've got little different kind of shops there. You know, watchmaker shop, jewelry shop, this kind of thing. And in the scene, I go over and I look into the jewelry section there, and I see a ring, and I make a statement to the effect, "Yeah, well, I don't have enough money for that." And so I was supposed to pick up a brick right there by the street sign where guys were working, and I was supposed to crack the window and steal the ring. So as we're getting ready to go ahead and do this scene, I walk around from the back of the set, and I see the whole set is held up by a couple of 2x4s propped up. And so I noted that, you know. So as I came around, and they said, "Okay, action, go." And so I walk down. I look in the jewelry store window, and I go and pick up a brick. So as I'm walking back to the window, I remembered in the back, this whole set was by just a couple of 2x4s propped up. And this was a real brick, by the way.
Yeah.
And so my thought was, if I hit this doggone window real hard, like it should be, you know, to make a real good scene of it, this whole thing is just going to, you know, it's gonna fall apart. So I just kind of namby-pamby tapped on the window, you know. And as soon as I did that, Alan Freed was sitting on the side. He said, "Cut! Cut!" What are you doing? You know, namby-pamby? He said, "You got to hit the window, you know, do a manly thing." I said, "Alan, this whole set," he said, "No, right, I'm telling you, hit the window." I said, "Alan, the whole set is yellow." I said, "Hit the window with a brick." "Okay, here we go." "Okay," he said, "ready, action, take." So I went over, we planted, picked up the brick, right?
Yeah.
I walk over to the window, and I mean, it was a take like a Steve McQueen, Paul, what was that great actor?
Paul Newman?
Yeah, like they would do, you know. And I hit that window. So help me God. All of a sudden, you hear. And the whole cockpit just absolutely toppled. And bam! The whole thing. Big, wham! I mean, it was like 40 feet long. The whole thing just cracked. I looked over and then Helen, I said, "I told you what." It took them probably another hour to clean up the glass and to get the stick and it all back up. And this time they propped it up really strong, so when I redid it. So Jimmy Clinton knocked down the whole set of Go Johnny Go.
You were right. That is a funny story.
Okay, Sandy, you're on the chat. What are we playing now?
We got you baby,
oh,
it's
yeah.
You.
Okay, so after I did Everybody Needs Love, that whole CD, I just got on a songwriting kick. And I've got one page on my, by the way, I'm on Facebook. I've got page one and page two. Page one is pretty well filled up. Page two there you can still get on. And I've got, Sandy came up with this, there's a Jimmy Clinton group on Facebook. And it's just for everybody to have a ball. Post all your pictures of Jimmy Clinton. Tell all your stories of when you first heard me, when you first met me. And it's been a blast. And everybody, Mary Teresa is pretty much heading up that Jimmy Clinton group. She comes up with stuff I didn't even know I existed. Yeah, it's pretty phenomenal. So everybody has a ball with Jimmy Clinton group. So I started writing new songs, and I had written this song, and I'll never forget. I'm up in my bedroom right now where I was sitting, and as I was finishing that song on my guitar, I looked out the door, and I heard Sandy said, she yelled up at me, "I love it!" And I, if Sandy loves it, we got something. So I put it all together, And I put it together with that swamp pop Louisiana tenor sax sound. And I'm proud of my songwriting again. And I sang it pretty well, too, thank God. It's called You, Baby, It's You.
You, Baby, It's You. Oh, my goodness. Oh, Jimmy, you got me to do something that I haven't done in a long time, and that was snort on the air. Thank you so much.
I've had a very interesting career.
All right, you're the host at the most. You got the mic. Go for it.
A couple of years ago, you just never know, but you try to make sure that you've crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's, you know? And so I had this, I'm known on my shows, all my fans know it, that I absolutely have the coolest top of the line, top drawer, bling bling wardrobe. Everybody knows that in my shows. Everybody knows it. I've had one fan say, can you tell me what you're going to wear at your next show? Because I've seen every show. I've seen every outfit. So if it's going to be a brand new outfit, I've got to know what show that is. I've got to see you. they do not want to miss a show when it's a new bling bling. And Sandy's done well to pick all that out. Anyway, so I've got this incredible red, I mean hot, hot red suit. And I've got different belts. So we're going to the show a couple of years ago, and I'm in the dressing room. I usually get dressed about 30 minutes before I know they're getting ready to bring me on, because that gives me enough time.
Right.
So I put on my red suit there and pants, and I reach for my belt. And I start to put the belt on, but I did not take the correct belt. I had a belt that was too small.
Uh-oh.
I had no belt.
Uh-oh.
I'm holding up my suit pants. Now, it is too late. Now, there are only two songs away, so I've got to go downstairs, and I'm around, and by the time I get down there around the edge, they're doing their last chorus of the last song, and the DJ is coming on. He's getting ready to introduce me. I have no belt. I cannot keep my pants up. And I'm serious as a heart attack. So there's a guy standing next to me. I said, hey, he was just there with a group or somebody. And I said, hey, do you have a belt? And he said, yeah, I've got it on. I said, well, man, I said, you know, I didn't get the right belt, and I've got to have a belt. He said, I can't give you my belt. He said, I need my belt to keep my pants up. I said, well, that's my problem. And he didn't say it, but he kind of looked at it like, well, that's your problem. That's correct, you know. And so I'll never forget. Now the guy's going, ladies and gentlemen, living legend, Teen Idol. And I look at the wall and I said, oh, my God, dear Lord, please do something. So I do not have to, my pants don't slip down, please. So that it had Jimmy Clinton. So as I walk on, underneath my jacket, I'm holding my pants up. Now, Sandy doesn't know what's going on. She may want to say something in a minute. So I walk over and I take the microphone. Now, you got 1,000 fans, you know, they're running, Jimmy, doing it, they're screaming. And I walk over to the mic stand, hold my pants up, and I look at, here's what I said. Can we talk? I never pre-plan anything in my shows except the songs I'm going to sing.
Right.
And I just looked at it and I said, folks, I got a problem. And I told him what happened, and I said, I want my pants to fall down. Well, about 300 of them screamed, let him go, let him go. Took a bow, and as I walked off, I thanked everybody as I held up my pants with my one hand. But I made for sure, when I got home, I never forgot to have the correct belt. So you don't think things like they're going to happen again, right? Wrong. Just recently. So I've got this incredible new jacket, and I'm going to wear tux pants with it. And so we get to the rehearsal, and I've been really watching my weight to make sure I stay down at the weight to make sure my clothes fit well. And so I tighten up my the tux pants, which are just tightened with the little clips on the side. I said, man, this is great. You know, I've lost weight, so now I can really tighten these all the way. Well, so I go on stage, and after one song, it starts to hit me. These freaking tux pants are starting to slip down.
Oh, no.
And I looked out at everybody, and I said, I got to tell y'all something. I said, you just bear with me. I said, I've lost a lot of weight, and I said, I'm having to do all I can to keep these tux pants up. Well, they howled, oh, they love that. Let it go, let it go, let it go. So I found out when we got home that it was the wrong tux pants, that I should have brought the other pair. So, you know, crazy stuff can happen on stage, I'll tell you. Yep. That must have been Sandy from the chat room, right?
She goes, ask him about the time he fell into the stool on stage.
Tell him about the stool. Oh, I'm doing a major show. I'm doing a major show at this incredible, incredible $1 billion venue in Philadelphia, 32-piece orchestra. And the act just before me had a stool up there because one of them was sitting, I guess. And so I pushed it away. And I'm doing my show. And all of a sudden, I do a little spin, and oh, my God, I didn't remember the stool was still there.
Oh, no!
I ran into the freaking stool, but I did so in a way that I did a little cool thing with my leg and sat on the stool as if I planned the whole thing.
Linda said, Jimmy, Linda Grisso is saying Jimmy is an accidental comic.
So somehow or another, I landed on the stool and it just looked like I planned it. I went, oh my God, thank you, Lord.
I would have loved to seen that. I'm picturing it in my head. I'm a very visual person, you know.
Oh, my gosh. I couldn't believe it. I did not. I forgot that stool was there. Yeah. Okay, here's a song that I wrote with an incredible guitar solo by Pershing Wells. And, it's an illustration of, I put it like this. I say, folks, how do I do it, Sandy? I forget how I came up with this cute little thing where I write it and then I illustrate it by singing it. And so I wrote this next song. It's a Jimmy Clanton love song, as the way Jimmy Clanton writes and sings.
Illustrate it.
Yeah, that's it. Okay. I illustrated. All right. So here's an illustration of a song I wrote called I'll Die For You.
We'll be right back, folks. Oh, I would die for you, Jimmy Clanton. Oh, my goodness. Have y'all even heard what was going on in the background? All right, you're those with the most. You got the mic. Go ahead, Jimmy.
I'm supposed to be able to have swag, but the way it's looking like it's swinging away. Good grief. All the listeners out there, I'm not in charge. I can tell you, these women are just bossing me around here.
Only one woman's bossing you around, and she's where you're at.
We're going to go into the next song, and I'll admit, Pershing Wells did an arrangement on this next song, and somebody asked Sandy, can you describe this song? And it was amazing because it was one word. She said, there's no question, celestial. Mm. It's called I'll Bring It to You, and it is truly a celestial sound song. Go ahead and play it, Debbie.
I'll bring it to you, Jimmy Clinton. Celestial. I can't say that word. Go ahead, Jimmy. You got the mic.
Well, about 5 months ago, I started thinking about retirement. And I'd like to mention there are a few shows that are coming up, and they will be the last of my career in that area. Looking here, I've got a show in California, August the 18th, in San Bernardino. I've got a show in somewhere in Texas coming up in September. And I've got a show in Schenectady, New York, October 20th. And those shows in those areas are going to be the last of my career. So if you've never seen me and you're in that area, that's it, folks, because I'm shutting it down, Debbie. I'm looking at 80 years of age, and yeah, I've been blessed, and my voice, thank God, is still in good shape.
Mm-hmm.
I'm physically in good shape, but I really want to stop and smell the roses out in life, you know. So
yeah. Oh, I totally understand where you're coming from, and you know, this comeback that you made, I mean, it had to have been a pretty amazing for you.
It was, and the song that you're getting ready to play is very, very poignant and special to me. I wrote this song, and I wrote this song probably 9-10 years ago now, when I was getting ready to do this show at a casino in New Orleans. I said, you know, if I was getting ready to do my last show, where would I want it to be? I'd want it to be in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would think so.
And unbeknownst to me, now you fast forward like 8 years later, and I get a call from a promoter in my hometown of Baton Rouge. And the bottom line is, here's what he says. He says, why don't you come back to do a show? And I told him, I'm looking at my wrapping it up, final show. He said, why don't you do that show you're talking about? He said, here in Baton Rouge. And he said, I would like for you to do it on the stage of the high school that you graduated from over 60 years ago.
Oh, God, you just gave me goosebumps again. That's wonderful.
So lo and behold, last year, I think it was around this time, last of May, I went back to Baton Rouge and walked up on the stage that I have not been on since 1956 when I got my diploma. And I, having no idea of a career that was coming forth, no idea of ever coming back as Jimmy Clinton, the notoriety that I carried for music, to my high school stage, and it was just filled with all of my schoolmates and fans that came from all over America. Some came from Canada for that show, and there I was on that stage doing all my hits on the stage of my high school that I graduated from, Baton Rouge High School. Gorgeous venue, gorgeous sound, and I would also like to say it is now finished in a DVD with professional filming, professional sound, and if you can obtain that last DVD of that entire one-man show, the final show of my one-man career in Baton Rouge High, it is available on my website. Just go to my store at jimmyclinton.com. And so I did that show, and as I getting ready to do the last song before I'm saying goodbye. And boy, I'll tell you, it's my heart is just in my throat.
Yeah.
And here I tell the story of how I wrote this song, never thinking for a minute that it would come to fruition on the stage of my very loving high school that I love so much and all the people that I love so much. And I did this song as my closing song on that stage, Baton Rouge High School, and it's called Lovin' Louisiana.
Lovin' Louisiana by Jimmy Clinton, the living legend, right here on the Debbie Scott Radio Network. All right, Jimmy, you're the host with the most tonight. So you're gonna, I know you say you're going to retire, so You said you would like to come back and do your farewells on my show.
Well, I told you if you would like,
yes.
Maybe next year, you and I and Sandy will stay in touch between now and then, and we'll let you know in plenty of time, and I'll be more than happy to come on. I'll probably tear up, but when I
we all will. We all will, Jimmy.
When I say goodnight and goodbye, I'll still have, YouTube has so much of Jimmy Clinton music,
mm-hmm.
and Sandy and I haven't talked about our Facebook pages, but the Jimmy Clinton group on Facebook is so incredibly popular, so we probably will keep that going because the fans look forward to that. But as far as out for one-man shows and doing shows nationally, that'll be it.
Yeah.
So, yes, we'll come on and say goodbye, okay?
Absolutely.
This last song, and I'm going to say goodnight with this. This song was written, and I recorded it back in 1976. And the reason it is so poignant is because it's a song about a guy who had all these hits, was so popular, but now the heavy metal and the English invasion has taken over.
The British. It was the British invasion.
British?
Yeah, British.
Did I say English?
Yeah, you did, but that's okay.
You're right, British invasion.
Yeah.
And it's a song about a guy, and he's like sitting on his rocking chair thinking about those days, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he's saying, will it happen again? Well, the thing is that I put that out. And now, fast forward to 1994, when I got an incredible call from a guy, and he said, I had an unlisted phone number. I'd gotten out of the business. He said, people have been asking for you, and I've been looking for you for 17 years.
Wow.
And I said, Richard, I said, I don't do bars anymore. He said, no. He said, these are venues. These are sit-down concerts. The people want to see you all again. So I agreed. And what was so interesting is that the people received me as if it were 1958, 1959 again.
Yeah.
And it's like that. I mean, I say this very humbly, standing ovations after I do my show, And so this last song represents something that I didn't think was going to happen in 1976, but the last part says, will it happen again? Well, guess what? It has. My fans know it. And everybody knows it that loves me. So as you play this song, I want you to know, Debbie, I've so enjoyed being with you. I appreciate your fan base. And thank you all for loving our music. And will it happen again? Is this old rock and roll getting ready to say? Yeah, it's happening again. It's been happening. And I'm glad that we all have been a part of it. Thank you very much. God bless you. Good night, everybody.
Thank you, Jimmy.
Thank you, Debbie.
Straight James.